Also because I don't understand all these subtleties myself quite yet. So I'm not sure even.
Is there any reference where we can check the subtleties and today maybe we can just in the blackboard see the, I don't know, the big picture?
Yeah, so I haven't really seen. Oh, no, wait. I haven't seen anything really where it's really explained in all detail. But it might be in one of the recent. So there's a very recent review of Dan Fried, by Dan Fried. It might be in there. But, so what I've been using was mainly. No, this is a bit too dark, in fact, for the moment. This master's thesis of. Where did it go? Oops. Yeah, yeah, this one, yes. No, why is it?
Up.
Okay, this is, I thought it was, you know, the right arrow was turning it by 90 degrees, but yeah, so this master's thesis is quite, things are quite well explained, but he has some mistakes. And I guess I'm going to get to those.
Master.
Yeah. Uh-huh. All right.
The degree is in master.
Yes, I think so. So I wanted to explain the main kind of, or one of the main reasons for describing a TQFT in terms of a functor. And that is this classification thing, that one can use this idea in order to give a pretty detailed classification of TQFTs. And so at least this has been worked out so far in two dimensions, meaning 1 + 1 dimensions, what I've been looking at so far mainly, and this is also the case which I would like to explain. Maybe we can go at some later point, also go out and look at the 2 + 1 dimensional case, which then would lead us to those things like fusion categories. But today, I'd like to explain this 1 + 1 dimensional case, which leads us to these Frobenius algebras. So we had been saying that then a two-dimensional TQFT is a functor F from this category of 2 cobordisms to the category Hilbert spaces, satisfying or basically preserving all the structure, like the monoidals, the tensor product, and these dualities. So an object, 2 cob, it's just a one-dimensional oriented manifold. And a morphism, or well, the set of morphisms from a one-dimensional oriented manifold sigma 1 to a one-dimensional oriented manifold sigma 2 is just the set of all two-dimensional oriented manifolds M with boundary. So these are manifolds with boundary. So that the manifold of M, if it's supposed to be a morphism from sigma 1 to sigma 2, its boundary has to be sigma 1. This joint union with sigma 2 of the opposite orientation. So this we already all discussed, right? And modulo, so we're going to impose an equivalence relation on these manifolds, namely, oriented diffeomorphisms preserving the boundaries. I'm not going to define this precisely, but basically we have to identify these. two such cobordisms whenever they just, well, look the same. So this is modulo the equivalence relation of oriented diffeomorphism. I guess it's not, you can't see it. Yeah, I know. Sorry, yeah. So this is just to make this into a set, so to speak, because otherwise there would be just too many. And also in order to, for example, get the cylinder, example, so the cylinder over the circle, to make this into the identity morphism, we need to impose, or we need to quotient out by this equivalence relation, because otherwise this would not really be an identity, right? Gluing in a cylinder kind of changes the manifold. But it's still the same manifold up to diffeomorphism, so this is kind of a technical point that we have to quotient out. Okay, now there is, what's nice about this category is that one can actually describe it in terms of generators and relations, meaning that there is a finite set of objects, so of one-dimensional manifolds, such that every other object is a tensor product of those. And there's also a finite set of cobordisms, or of morphisms, such that every other one is can be obtained by tensor products and compositions of these kind of generating ones. So this is basically what we've said previously, that we can cut, or we can build up every cobordism from these elementary pieces. So these are the generators, and then there are also, there's a finite set of relations, meaning that every, whenever we build up a cobordism from these elementary pieces, and we can do this in two different ways, or we have two different cobordisms between the same two, sigma 1 and sigma 2, then they are equivalent, and so they represent the same morphism if and only if one can go from one of them to the other via a finite sequence of moves. Maybe you've seen this, for example, also in knot theory, which has those randomizer moves, which is saying that, well, two knot diagrams represent topologically the same knot if and only if there's a finite number of moves taking one to the other. And this is kind of the same for this category 2 cob. So,
uh-huh.
Yes.
So it's interesting, like if you look at two cops, so do you consider that as finite number generators when you have different genuses? That they consider infinite number, account for family of generators, or how do you consider
it? So in three cop one has to really, if one wants to do this right, one wants to obtain a sort of a finite number of generators and relations, one has to consider 3 cop as a 2 category at least. Because then we can glue also all the two-dimensional surfaces from, so then these are all one morphisms, right? And we can glue those from the one-dimensional ones, which are the circles and the two-dimensional pieces. So basically, so the same generators and relations which apply to 2 cop would then also appear in 3 cop, right?
Okay. So yeah, basically it was just, yeah, in case it was not clear what the finite generating means, it's not, the genus doesn't get generated.
No, it does. If you consider it as a... Yes, you're right. Yeah, if you consider it just as a monoidal category, then no, it doesn't get generated. Yeah.
Can you, maybe it's a naive question, can you give an example of this, how the quotient of the orientity for morphism works? Can you do an example like maybe do a cylinder H to be a torus? Any example you can give?
You just like flatten that cylinder, for example. There, that will be a diffeomorphism that presents boundaries. Like if you bulk it out and then come back, basically just deforming a little bit.
Okay, so it doesn't, like,
Yeah, so for example, if we take this pair of pins.
On this, it's not all.
No, that's wrong. And we glue the cylinder in here, well, then we still get, this is still diffeomorphic to the original pair of bands because we can just shrink the cylinder down to.
But can you include case you change the topology, like change the cylinder to torus?
No, because that would not be cool.
So this equivalence relation precisely takes care of. Of identifying things which have the same topology.
I mean, the deformation has to be continuous.
Yeah. Is there a way to generalize this to be not this, maybe with some surgery? I mean, this is a random question. I say, if I maybe brainstorm, say, well, can you think about, I want to change the cylinder to torus, then can I do a similar procedure originally that I took? I want to add some procedure like quotient or something and make this statement work. Maybe it doesn't make sense. But.
I guess it depends on what you want to do. Something that you're doing that is not sensitive to things other than, like up to more than up to dimorphism, maybe something only you care about, I don't know, example, physical example.
Yeah.
Then you might want to do a theory like that.
So, yeah. For example, if we change the context to a conformal field theory, then we have to consider, so not, well, cobordism manifolds here equipped with a conformal structure, and then we have to take the quotient with respect to conformal equivalence, or conformal diffeomorphisms. And then it turns out that, well, this then we don't just have kind of a countable or discrete set of morphisms between each two objects, but we have a whole space or a moduli space of morphisms.
And I thought maybe it's worthwhile pointing out that we'll be looking at a functor like from the Tuchel to Hilbert space. So if the Tuchel distinguishes all the different manifolds with different topologies, then it, this invariant that you get there, the TPLT will be stronger. Like that in particular, certain value you can pick out, like you can go back and say, oh, those are the ones that are like. But it's it gives you more information when you have a finer structure on the left hand side, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you calculate invariant. So if you quotient, then this function might not become a invariant of this quotient thing with the quotient thing on the left unless they give the same value originally in this construction. But you can recover that information in a way. Like say, let's say this is imaginary, like Tuchel has like infinite many objects, but let's say it has finite. Can you assign values on the right? It's hyperspace. Let's imagine we're in an C or something, or an N. Yeah, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 through N. So that's kind of a very strong invariant that captures all the things on the left hand side. That's sort of what PQP function, they're strong, let's do that. But now if you say, well, maybe zero is the same as 2 or 2 is the same as 4,
mm-hmm.
and you z mod 2 structure, and mod 2 structure, and then 1 is the same as 3 and 5, then, you're using the same on the right-hand side, you can just read out, okay, you give me 0, 2, 4, then they came from the same class, same equivalence
mm-hmm.
class, so manifold on the left. So this stronger environment contains the information in it. That you would get by defining a coarser structure on the modular structure on the left hand side. So it's a stronger thing that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's understand. Yeah. But. Yeah.
Well, stronger than some things, but weaker than other things.
Like,
but in the example that you gave, the second one
is weaker in the sense that I could not tell 1 from 3 or
okay,
5.
So it is weaker.
Yeah, the second one's really good. But what we're doing right now is stronger than what Druven is suggesting, which is modeling out by more things on the left hand side.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
So, so I wanted to show some nice pictures of these generators and basic relations. Now I don't know where. Of course, in this week's Fine Mathematical Physics. Here. Okay, so this we discussed before, right? So these two are basically the elementary pieces together with their duals, meaning that just flipping two boundary manifolds. And these are the elementary equivalences. So these are the relations or the basic moves which one has to apply in order to get all these equivalences between kind of pastings of the generating pieces. Right, so this is kind of like an associativity, or in this case more like co-associativity axiom actually. So if we think of kind of two ingoing things and one outgoing thing, this is like, and this will actually turn two into the multiplication out into the algebraic structure of a sort of multiplication in algebra. So this is saying that if we first multiply the first two entries, then multiply the third entry, it's the same as if we first multiplied the second with the third, and then with the first. So this is just an associativity axiom. Well, this will turn into an associativity axiom. And similarly, well, so this cup, if we think of this cup in the same way, it takes zero inputs and produces one output. So this is like a unit element. This is like a constant. So algebraically, this will become a constant. And so this is saying that if we multiply the constant with something, then this relation says we just get that something, because if we get the identity on something. And similarly here, if you plug in the constant as the second argument and some input, we just get the input back. So then these two relations are saying that this constant is the unit, is going to be a unit for that multiplication. So these are basically the axioms of a monoid, so well, of a group up to having inverses.
And the cup is a particular constant, like a fixed one.
Yeah. Well, a constant is
basically one.
Just one, yeah. Uh-huh. And so these are the same just for the duals. So we don't have to impose these additionally, because actually these follow from the duality structure of the category. So. And in addition, these two moves or equations. So, well, I guess here at least one can visualize that these also really represent the same cobordism or an equivalent cobordism, right? Because, I mean, you can just deform kind of this bend further down and this bend and further up, and then we end up with this picture and the same here. So these also represent the same cobordisms, and therefore there should be some, well, and these don't follow from the previous moves, so these kind of should be imposed additionally and separately. And this commutativity, this will turn into the commutative law, or saying that the multiplication is commutative. And well, remember that it doesn't matter whether in these two crossing tubes, it doesn't matter how we draw them. If we draw the crossing of the right one on top or the left one on top, because we're not working with our manifolds are not embedded anywhere. So when we draw them like this, it's just because we need, in order to draw them, we need to embed them somewhere. But So they're abstract manifolds, and so there is no notion of crossing there. It's just saying that the right output, the right input becomes the left output, and the left input becomes the right output.
Sorry, what was the point about the constants? I don't understand what that picture is telling me. So, and why is
this,
you're getting like you were saying, like something out of nothing, right? So why is that constant? And what is that picture?
Because it's much like, well, so the picture is just an equivalence between cobordisms, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
So this thing of the constant, this is going to be the interpretation, or this is going to be what this equation will mean for such functors on the codomain, on the Hilbert space level. But, or roughly speaking, you can also take it at, so, in the axioms for a group, for example, a constant, there's a constant in the unit element of the group, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and this constant I can regard as a map taking no input and producing an output, namely producing that constant as its output. So this is kind of like this cup here, right? Because it takes, well, it starts from nothing and ends up with the circle, and it has its other boundary, the circle.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it seems to me that it produces more than a constant, right? It produces a circle or a Hilbert space or something.
Yes, but in the same way you can say that, well, if we regard the constant or the unit element of a group as a function from the one element set, so I'm going to denote the one element set by this, so we can regard it as a function from the one element set to the group.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, this is the same, right? The codomain is also not just one element. The codomain here also is the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same way, the codomain there is the whole circle.
Okay.
All right, so now there's kind of a mathematical theorem saying that these are all the moves you need in order to generate all the equivalences between the cobordisms formed by these pans and cups and caps.
Commutativity is always there just because it's 1 plus 1. Maybe because
Which one is always there?
Like commutativity of the circles, it's always there somehow.
What do you mean by commutativity of the circle?
I mean when you cross, you said there's no notion of real crossing.
So there's a notion of crossing, but there's no notion of braiding. That's what I meant.
Okay.
So it's a symmetric monoidal category, not.
And is this because we are studying a particular case, or because in general it's always like this fact that you can.
But you compared to higher dimension, for example, can you contrast with like.
This doesn't depend on the dimension, so this will be, I mean, because in all dimensions we're working with abstract manifolds and not embedded ones, right? So when we have two,
why do we get braiding in the dimension?
Because sometimes we work with embedded manifolds. It just depends on the context. In some contexts, we're using embedded, like in knot theory.
What's the question?
Like the fact that you can, there's no difference.
There's
why
no
is it symmetric? Why is it symmetric?
There's no braiding, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the argument in. It's just embedded, but I always want to contrast with other, you know, knowledge from elsewhere where you don't, that seems not to be true and understand the difference.
Should we write this down in more detail? Should we write this kind of should write this crossing or exchange homomorphism down explicitly? Yeah, okay. So when we have two objects in the category, well, let's say sigma 1 and sigma 2, we got this sigma 1 tensor sigma 2, which just represents their disjoint union, right? And now, so this would be the domain of the crossing, and the codomain would be well, we're using the same two manifolds, but now in opposite, using the tensor in the opposite order. So sigma 2 tensor, sigma 1. Now there's a, we want to have morphism in that way, which should be then a manifold M with boundary. First of all, this, so sigma 2 tensor sigma 1, well, which on the level of the manifolds is just disjoint union. Disjoint union sigma 1 union sigma 2, oppositely oriented. But, well, if you're taking this opposite orientation, we can as well do this before taking the disjoint union. So, well, in the end, this just boils down to a manifold M, which has sigma 1 union sigma 1 bar as its boundary, and another manifold which has sigma 2, or we can take it to be a disjoint second manifold, which has sigma 2 union sigma 2 bar as its boundary. So we can just take the cylinder over sigma 1, which thus kind of the first job, and sigma 2, the cylinder over sigma 2, which satisfies in the second thing.
So I guess I want to point out that it's because this is a top dimension, right? You compare it to the 1, 2, which is max, is a top dimension for the PQ of T.
Uh-huh.
But somehow, suppose you are looking at like a one thing in three, that's when but 2-3, like you say, you have a 2-3-3-2 theory,
mm-hmm.
is still true that it's symmetric in the top dimension. Like
mm-hmm.
the two can exchange with the two.
Yeah.
But you look the one in it, then it
uh-huh.
loses symmetric nature.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say I want to point out that like, you know, something graphs like a similar thing, not the same, appears in anionic systems where you have gradients, but those are one dimensional, and that's when you have like non-trivial gradients.
But so why is that? Is that because we're working with kind of embedded manifolds, or is it because we're working with really kind of extended TQFTs?
Yeah, but that's even like, yeah, the defect TQFT sort of slightly different notion.
Yeah.
But similar structure up here that is still associated
mm-hmm.
with, like, even though it's not looking at exactly the extended picture, maybe it's also extended. Some people think the 3-1, the one you get the defect.
Mm-hmm.
But another way to look at is defect picture. So I mean, so the thing is just, it can be a little bit confusing that these structures, like similar, some of this sort of generating relations appear in different contexts, that they sit in the TQFT in different ways. So the grading case is you have a 3 default, and this is 1 defect you're grading. So you are not abstractly grading the one, and you're not abstractly those line effects
don't sit
in that. Like that's
what's
sort of the part of the conclusion.
Uh-huh.
Because it's top dimension symmetry.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
that's a good point. Yeah.
Can I say something? No, you go first. So I don't understand, but I want to say that it seems to me that I also think about the equivalent that you are trying to prove the equivalent between this chain and this.
No, these are not. Oh, sorry. So without putting the pants here, these are not equivalent, right? But only together with when gluing these two things to the pants, then these become equivalent covertisms.
Yes. But what I want to say is, I guess what I say is wrong. Right? So I guess the TQFT language is related to certain categories. And normally, I know in this direction it's not time, and it's not like two-dimensional things. But we know there's some grading rules in this annual system which can be non-ideal in some way.
Right.
And in that case, when we exchange the annual, along some old line, the way that it may have some non-ideal matrix.
Right.
And one understand whether this case.
Aren't you talking about
constrain certain category, or say that this case is corresponding to a certain category, the one with this exchange rule with the pens.
What do you mean correspond to a certain category?
So
well, we have.
No, on the right, you mean. So, for example, maybe you refer to if you change
no.
the target category on the right, do you ever get non-symmetric things? Is that what you're asking?
Maybe I'm saying that whether this corresponds to certain category with self-rating rule.
You mean a particular TQFT or?
Yeah, the TQFT here corresponds.
A TQFT corresponds to a Frobenius algebra into in this one plus one dimensional case.
Yes.
That's what I'm going to. Get to.
By the way, there may be a generalized case where this rule doesn't really work.
Whereas in I guess you're aren't you talking about the 2 plus 1 dimensional case?
Yeah, we are
yeah,
probably talking about 2 plus 1. It's a different topological setting on the left hand side. It's not because the problem on the right hand side.
So that in the 2 plus 1 dimensional case, then a TQFT really has an associated category, right? This fusion category. This is kind of then the so that would be kind of well one dimension up.
So this is
1 plus
yeah.
1, right? Because the space, so our boundary manifolds are one dimensional, and the evolution in between or this kind of interpolating cobordisms are 1 plus 1 dimensional.
Okay.
So this is one dimension below, which would make it a bit more basic. I guess. Okay, so there's a theorem saying that these are all the moves one needs in order to get equivalence between all these pastings. And so now, the nice thing about this, and this is really the main point, and this is how one can use algebraic things to classify two-dimensional TQFTs, is that these generators and generating moves allow us to characterize any such functor F by an algebraic structure in this category. So I guess I should elaborate this on this a bit. So because every object is just, we can just get by, well, it's just a finite union of circles. We know that the functor is going to be determined on the objects by its image of the circle. So this is the Hilbert space, which determines F on objects. And similarly, the generating morphisms or generating cobordisms determine F on all cobordisms, right? Because, well, if we have any cobordism, we can just cut it into these elementary pieces. We know how F behaves on each piece, and then functoriality and preservation of the tensor product tells us how F has to behave on the whole, on a big cobordism manifold. So, on the morphisms, we need to specify how F behaves on the cup, and let's say on, I want to take this cap here. And on the pair of pins. So this determines F morphisms. So here I'm also using that F is assumed to preserve the dualities in a sense that reversing the cobordism should go to under F should go to the adjoint linear map. So when we know how F behaves on this cap, we also know how F behaves on the cup. And if we know how F behaves under this thing, we also know how it behaves under the.
So
we're
taking F the circle to be a vector space?
A Hilbert space. So our domain, a codomain category is a category of Hilbert spaces. So it automatically comes, we automatically have these staggers in there and can take, and this is relevant because they're F. So the requirements on F are being a functor, preserving a tensor product, and to be compatible with the dualities, meaning that it has to map the reverse cobordism to the adjoint of what it takes the original cobordism to.
You mean for example, you don't need to compute for instance for the cylinder because the cylinder is a completion of those two guys, so okay.
Actually, well, for the cylinder, so a cylinder, let's say for any one-dimensional sigma, so this is the cylinder. So this represents the identity morphism from sigma to sigma, right? And because we require F to be a functor, this has to go to the identity map from the Hilbert space F of sigma to F of sigma. So functoriality comprises two things, right? That it preserves the composition and that it takes identity morphisms to identity morphisms. And so that it takes the cylinder, which is the identity morphism in 2-cop, it also needs to take to the identity operator on the Hilbert space.
And if you have n cylinders, it's also identity on the bigger tensor product.
As a particular example, if I want to compute, for instance, this cylinder using your two generators here, I could do it. For instance, I just glue the cap on the top of this band, and I have the equivalent class of a cylinder. Right?
You don't even have to do. Yes. So that's one
I
way.
Want you to
yeah.
See
okay.
How I can do that.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Okay. Yes.
But before you do that, can I ask you a question? The morphisms, are they going to be unitaries, or do they preserve the tensor product? You don't require that.
No.
Okay.
Neither of that. Just, well, bounded linear maps within the Hilbert space. Okay, yes, so now, well, I'm also going to say things which will contain that computation.
So,
now, can we specify any Hilbert space? So this will be a Hilbert, yeah. So we can let's try to choose any define a TQFD by fixing a Hilbert space assigned to the circle, and then we need to also specify two linear maps, right? So the first linear map would be just going from the functor applied to the empty manifold, which is required to be just the Hilbert the one-dimensional Hilbert space of just the complex numbers to the Hilbert space kind of the theory, or so the Hilbert space of the circle is kind of the Hilbert space of states of the theory. So this we have to specify this linear map, and we have to specify this linear map, which corresponds to a map from the Hilbert space of the theory tensor itself to the Hilbert space of the theory. So now the question is, can we choose any such maps? And so why not?
Because you have to be complete. associated.
Yeah, exactly. So we have to be compatible with those equivalences in a sense that so we have this equivalence. This is now what Joseph was asking. Or in when we construct the cylinder in this way, so this is going to be what RF that we try to construct will assign to this is going to be the following composition of linear maps. So on this level, maybe it's better to put also the cylinder here. So we're starting with, initially, just the Hilbert space of the theory. Right. So for the kind of ingoing things on top, we have just this Hilbert space. Now in the middle, we have suddenly two Hilbert spaces. So let me call this, this is this map eta and this map mu. So what we have to do now here is to take eta and tensor it with the identity operator. Which will take us to f of, which will take us to here. And now, well, we're just applying mu. So this is how we would compute the operator associated to the cylinder. But now on the level of the category of cobordisms, we're seeing that this is the same cobordism, or well, this is just the cylinder, right? This whole thing. So this should be the same thing as the cylinder of F applied to the cylinder, but because it's required to be a functor, this has to be the identity operator on F of on our Hilbert space. And well, we can do the same reasoning for any one of those moves.
Right? Sorry, shouldn't you reverse orientation so at the basis and at the endpoint? Is it okay?
Yes and no, it depends. Well, this is one of the subtleties. So usually the way that these cobordisms are drawn, so is that one would draw the cylinder as the thing of the orientation itself. But so this would be, well, but in M itself, so in the cobordism itself, the orientation actually goes this way. So because we're saying that the boundary of M has to be sigma 1 union sigma 2 bar.
But then it doesn't go that way though. I think because the two, even though they go the same way as we see it, it's relative. Just as this is relative, they're different relative to the thing in the middle.
Uh-huh.
So if you were in the middle, like if you point the vector upward with this orientation, the other one, so one points out with respect to this 2D thing, and the other one points in. So I think you still should draw the arrow the other way. It's just that from the perspective of that middle section, they look different.
Yeah, it's a rotation.
Yes.
Okay.
So it depends. Do we here? Are we going to draw here the orientation of sigma 2 or sigma 2 bar?
But you have to do it that way.
So either way, it's kind of wrong.
My point is, so when you write your mu stuff,
mm-hmm.
when I write f of sigma bar of the circle, which orientation should I use at that point? Is it what I ask? I mean,
at which
yes, your right hand side. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So when I write it like this, does it mean the orientation, the Hilbert space or the Hilbert space bar is what I'm asking. You know, is it?
Yeah. No, it means the Hilbert space itself.
Itself.
Yes,
right.
Because the pair of pins So when we draw it with its original or its kind of natural orientation, it'll look like this, right? Where it will also have the orientation on this outgoing circle going the other way.
You should not draw this way, because if you draw this way for an ant walking on that 2D surface, the two, they actually, now if you draw it this way, then all three boundaries look the same to them. So they actually, if you draw it this way, you will get sigma 1 union sigma 2 union sigma 1 union sigma 2. You won't get this opposite thing looking from the inside. You have to draw the other, you have to draw it the other way.
Not sure I get.
So, maybe draw, because I want to demonstrate that what you were there, that one, the blue one is wrong.
Okay.
So, but sorry, I don't mean to do you wrong. But like if I were an ant walking here, let's say I have an arrow, like I have a little arrow, right? Then I approach this boundary, I'm going to say, okay, if I go along the circle in this way, my left hand side, is the out, is out. My left hand side is out. Now imagine I'm an ant walking here.
Your left,
from
my
all
left
the
hand side is out.
So that's sort of the idea about the relative orientation of the two, the smaller dimensional to the bigger. So now imagine the ant, because it's all local, right? Everything's local. So imagine I'm an ant aligning myself with the boundary. I don't know what's outside. And I'm just going to say, I walk along the marking, the arrow on the boundary. Then for this ant, also left hand side is out. And then you actually, this code for this particular
group. What do you mean my left hand side?
Like if you walk, let's say this is the edge. I walk along here. I know I'm on the right hand side of the edge when I walk along it.
Okay.
So you see what I mean is this, if you look
right.
At this.
Right. So if we walk this way, we know we're on the left hand side of the edge.
Oh, we're on the right hand side of the edge. But the left hand side is outside.
No, then the manifold is to the right of us.
Yeah, that's right. Our manifold is to the right of this line, the boundary we cannot cross, right? So same as this one. So let's call these two together as your sigma one, and this one as sigma two. I mean, so what we get in this case actually is going to be sigma one union sigma two, and we know our opposite orientation, because if I end, like, from this side, so you actually, this is wrong, which means you actually should reverse the orientation of this thing.
Yes, exactly.
That's
what I was trying to say essentially. Yeah.
But I mean, like, you don't have to change how the arrow goes from our perspective.
It always depends which arrow do we draw. So do we draw the arrow of sigma 2 or do we draw the arrow of sigma 2 bar?
No, we should always.
So what you're saying, we should draw the arrow of sigma 2 bar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always
yeah. So just, okay. Yes, so the one I had I was drawing originally, the one which was going that way, which was the one of sigma 2.
Yeah.
Right? But because... No, sorry, I meant sigma 2.
No, that was right.
Oh, yes.
That was right.
No.
That's right.
Look, from your diagram, it's an orientation of sigma 2 symbol, and you don't want that. So you should write the one of sigma 2 bar.
No, I'm totally confused. Okay, so you're saying that the orientation.
You should go the same direction as the one
from the top.
For being sigma bar.
For being sigma 2
yes.
bar.
Yeah.
So you're saying that this pair of bands has as a boundary orientation.
Sigma 2 bar?
Yes.
Yep.
No, but I think that's wrong.
See, the thing is, it should be sigma 2 if you just label the boundary it from our absolute perspective. But it's only from the pair of hands inside that you see the opposite. Right?
It's about the
view from where
it's as you say, it's not an embedded manifold. It's
right. Okay.
So you have to put yourself inside of this guy and look at it. It's turning like this, right?
Yeah.
And when you look like that, it turns like that.
Okay, well, let's
finish
the start because.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
Now I'm totally confused. I have two circles and say they're copies of each other, and they both have arrows going in one direction and it's the same direction.
Yeah.
And then I take this circle and put it at the bottom and on top of the transect. They were saying they somehow along by this operation they flip, and then for them to be actually bar, I have to flip and flip and flip it back again, or what? Okay, so you take that guy on the rock. Okay, how does it work? It's working like, no, yes, like this. All right, and you want to go like that. Okay, mm-hmm. So you go outward. And actually, you have to take the orientation inward, like this, for having a good orientation. Because it should be, you know, the you know, and now it turns.
Yeah, but then that should go the other way.
No, it should go.
So that tells you which.
Which way?
So previously it was turning like this, no?
But you want the orientation of the thing down.
No, no, no,
go
no,
outside
no.
of the manifold, right?
No, you don't.
No,
that's
you
right.
You
want one in, one out. That's all you want.
You want everything.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's
for the opposite orientation on the back, you need that it goes back.
Yeah.
Inward.
So it's not a manifold that happens.
So I guess when you have circle, like you this is not like one sphere with three equally treated circles on it, the pen, because there, some of them are in circles, some of them are out circles.
Actually,
yes.
At the beginning of the
still,
this guy, he explained.
we could also consider, no, I'm not sure if I should draw that. Okay, let me show it in the thesis.
In the beginning of this thesis, he's playing this.
Yeah. Actually, it's about how can you take, how do you define the orientation, okay, on such a boundary manifold, okay? So you have to pay attention of what's the meaning of orientation here. It's about completing forms, you know, and take the right orientation. So you have to play a little bit with that, and everything will be okay. So
in higher dimension, you need a form. And this dimension,
mm-hmm.
You can just visualize.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, wait, that's the four. Okay, I could have.
We can
one.
Sort
yeah.
it out after if you want. You
yeah,
can continue with your talk.
I don't know what is
important.
Okay, I wanted to show this. Oh, why does it?
That's horrible.
Careful.
So how can I zoom in if I?
But you want to make it bigger.
Yeah.
Make it bigger is control plus. So
that's what I tried. Yeah.
Okay.
So we can also consider the pair of pins as kind of having three ingoing circles and no outgoing circle, right? So this thing. So this in this case, we don't have to worry about the bars because in this case, the orientation of the boundary, or the way we draw it, just coincides with the orientation induced on the boundary coming from the whole manifold, right? So here we see that they're all kind of going the same way, so to speak. So for the pair of pins, and maybe it's actually, maybe we should talk about this, about induced orientations and this in a bit more detail, or?
I think you should go on with what you have planned.
Yeah,
okay. Anyway, so if we turn one of those down so that we have these two inputs and one output, we see that in the actual orientation induced from the manifold, it kind of goes the other way around. So, but we want to. What we draw in these pictures is not, so in the output on the codomain of the cobordisms is not the orientation induced from the manifold, but what we draw is, in this case, the object being, which is the codomain, and this has the opposite orientation, so what we draw is sigma 2 bar.
That's good.
Okay.
Like time reverse and then quantum mechanics to pick up that minus sign.
Huh?
That's not going to.
That was just a little problem. Well, it's all turning around. That's like the thing of time is flowing up.
Yes. Yes, but turning the whole manifold around is not the same as reversing the orientation.
No, but you can reverse the orientation of subsystems.
What do you mean by a subsystem?
Well. If you can map this, I'm not sure it's exact, but you can map this whole structure into entanglement swapping.
Entanglement
yeah.
swapping. right? So you, yeah, I mean, I pick out which was a teleportation out of the rules above, and the cup is create an EPR pair, and cap is do a bell measurement. But I don't remember the other rules.
Yeah, it certainly has something to
so
do with
there,
it.
You can treat, think of that as time reversal when you expect to pick up a minus sign when you do time reversal.
So we have two different kind of dualities here, right? So the first duality being reverse the orientation, and that corresponds to, on the Hilbert space level, we require that to correspond to taking dual spaces, like from cat to a bra, and we can flip the whole thing upside down, and that corresponds to time reversal, and we acquire that to correspond to the adjoint, the Hermitian conjugation on the Hilbert space level. Yeah. Okay, so back to, now where do I have? Oh yeah, here. So we were saying that if our maps that we have, our operators in our Hilbert space that we assigned, we try to construct such an F, that it needs to, so this composition needs to be equal to the identity operator here. So, and for each of those relations, for each of these moves, we got such an equation between our operators, which it has to satisfy. And conversely, whenever we chose the operators in such a way that they satisfy all these relations that we get in this way, then this defines the TQFT, right? Because we know that these are all the generating moves that we need. So then we can reason, well, whenever we have two equivalent ones, they have to be related by these moves, and therefore our F is well defined in the sense that we get the same operator. This really, so this is the idea of using these categories and this functorial idea in order to classify TQFTs. Or where classification means kind of, in this case, means reducing it to a kind of finite algebraic structure. And then one can sort of classify significantly further even from there, but these are things I don't really know yet.
You mean that without mentioning anything about the image of the circle, I can check that all my axioms are satisfied?
No, we need to specify the image of the circle also. So this is part of the data. So this is so this algebraic data is precisely going to be a so-called commutative Dagger Frobenius algebra. So it's kind of, well, you know, like we define the notion of group in terms of a few generating maps or the multiplication and the unit, and you just satisfy a couple of relations. It's the same for a commutative Dagger of Frobenius algebra, just a bit more stuff. So yeah, so maybe now we can look at what that stuff in particular means. Or actually, I think I don't even have to write this down again because we already have all these things in here, right?
But, okay.
So now it's just.
So I guess what we're interested in is that the four equation four things that are related by cosines. So the idea is that from the left hand side topological equivalence, we get the right hand side is algebraic equivalence. So we get these two compositions equals the identity, and that was the point in translation. Are you going to write the algebraic equations that resulted from these?
No, I think I won't. Should I?
I just want to make it clear that it came from.
Well, I don't know. Should I write them down explicitly?
Like maybe a few, if you can.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Like the whole idea before, you know, writing so much is because you want the two algebraic sides. You want to derive the relation on the algebraic side.
So now I'm going to write H for the Hilbert space assigned to the circle just to. Have to write a bit less. So then let's take this equation, for example. So here we have that if we apply first this operation eta, which is, yeah, okay. So eta tensor the identity of the Hilbert space, and then afterwards apply mu. This is just required to be the identity of the Hilbert space. Now, if we write those maps a little bit more in terms of, well, okay, let's say, so eta is actually just a linear map from C to H. So this is, in other words, this is just a vector in H, because if we, the vector means being eta of 1, right, then it's uniquely specified. So we can as well kind of write, and we can also consider mu, which is a map from H tensor H to H. We can in particular apply this H to elementary tensors in here, in the sense of, well, stuff like mu tensor phi. So, and it's defined if we specify it on these. So we can also consider it as kind of a map from H tensor H to H, H times H. So it just takes pairs of vectors and turns them into a vector in a bilinear way. Right? It's enough to specify that. So then this is what this equation is saying, that so here we just have this constant, which we plug in as kind of the first argument for this mu. And the second argument of mu, just something. This we keep unspecified, or it's just a free variable. So what we get then if we write this mu in this form is that mu applied to, so now this is the constant eta, comma psi, which is now an arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space. This is required to be equal to psi.
So in this case, an arbitrary vector, but in order to write mu as just a not a tensor product, but just a product of two, like this is two, you have to take the basis, right? In order, otherwise it'll be over-constrained. You want to make sure it extends by linearity. So,
well, if it's bilinear, if you have just some bilinear map h times h to h, it's okay. No. If it's bilinear, it's fine, no? That's the universal property of tensor product.
Yeah, you need a bilinear, but you might get over-constrained if you let h1, h2,
no.
The arbitrariness define a new h1.
As long as it's bilinear, it always extends to...
Yes,
that,
but
that's
you
universal.
Have to extend, you have to do it on a basis.
No.
But you have the extension, otherwise you get over-constrained.
No.
Anyway,
that's the universal property of the tensor product, right? When we have a bilinear map from vector between vector spaces V, W, and U or whatever.
Yeah.
Bilinear means it this is arbitrary bilinear map, nothing to do with any basis. We have this inclusion of the elementary tensors here. And then the universal property of the tensor product says that there is a unique factorization or a unique linear map from the tensor product to here, such as this diagram commutes, right?
I thought the tensor product on quaternions was not well defined. And this is why.
I'm talking about vector spaces over fields over.
Right, but I can do that over quaternions, right? I mean,
no, the quaternions are not a field. Because they're not commutative, so fields are commutative.
Yeah, like you're right that if you require that thing to be bilinear, okay, but usually, I mean, anyway, I just meant like you can extend by bilinearity.
Uh-huh.
Right? So if you don't, you want to set the minimum amount of data, if that's enough to specify mu, it's
right.
Two
okay.
Things on the basis,
mm-hmm.
Then you can extend by bilinearity.
Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. Well, sorry if I. Personally, I don't like that very much because fixing a basis is always kind of evil, no?
It's not tedious.
Yeah.
Clunky.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so this saying that if we plug in eta to one argument and keep the other argument variable, just a free variable, we just get the other this other argument back. So this is like, so now we can really think of this mu as a multiplication, like the multiplication in a group, and of this eta as a unit element. So just as if we apply the multiplication to the unit element and something, we just get that something back. So this is what this equation says. So in this sense, the equivalence of this cohomology and this cohomology precisely corresponds to a unit, the unit law of a multiplication. And well, the other one, so this one is just going to be the other unit law, right? Here we keep the first, the second argument fixed and the first one free. And now we can just look at, well, all the other diagrams in a similar way. So this is just saying that this multiplication mu is required to be associative. Right, is that clear? I guess not. No, it should. And so this means that our Hilbert space actually has to be an algebra. This is what algebra means, or in terms of in the category of vector spaces. And now what about this? So what is this? If we translate, so this, yeah. So yeah, so this is what I kind of tried to hint at before. So this turns into the commutativity law for the multiplication. And well, now what about these? This looks a bit mysterious, no?
Like the compatibility of the
whole
multiplication
and
multiplication.
Yeah,
some. Mm-hmm.
What did you?
Well, is it something like the order in which you do the operations?
Right? Yeah, but what does it mean for this mu or on this algebraic level? It yeah, I don't know actually, really.
Yeah, like most people, some people might not know about co-multiplication, so it's kind of hard to answer that.
Yes, okay, so this mu, we're saying that this is an operator going like this, right? And we are also requiring this f to preserve the duality of Lipping. So this means that what f does on the opposite pants is that it's an operator, that it has to be an operation mu dagger going from h to h tensor h. So mu dagger really meaning the f joint of this multiplication. So this is called co-multiplication. Or a map of this form, which goes from something to, or which goes from, well, yeah, some set or some h to h tensor h. This is always usually called co-multiplication, which and leads to stuff like Hopf algebras and also these Frobenius algebras. So this is some kind of compatibility condition involving the multiplication and the co-multiplication, but I don't really have any good interpretation of it or even know how to think of it.
Is it imposed that the time reversal really corresponds to taking the dagger? Like, is it
pre-imposed? Yes. So these are the conditions on the functor f.
Then, so for example, then the second line of diagrams, can you remove it by just saying that,
yes,
you know, the topology can
mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we postulate that f preserves these dualities and set it and preserves these equations, then it will automatically preserve these equations. Or it become compatible, yeah.
There's really time here.
I like to think about time this way, but you know, it's personal taste. I like it downwards because the composition goes from earlier than next unitary half, what next linear transformation happens. So I imagine that's time. It's just
do other people?
Some people argue it's not time, maybe it's not physical.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't know if it's physical time.
Yeah. Yeah, so, well, yeah, so this means that we can identify a particular TQFT in this one plus one dimensional setting.
Just to say something about this question of time.
Right. So,
you could say that there is a kind of, not time, but abstract object, which counts as a number of composition.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a kind of your clock. Whenever it goes on from here to there, you say, it counts one, okay, etc.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, it's a totally abstract approach. You can say that there is a kind of order of composition, you are right.
No, please.
No, that's it.
I didn't quite.
You could have a kind of discrete time, is what I'm saying. That when you count the number of composition that you make, okay, you just count kind of count.
Right.
So that would be more in line of going down on the lattice and.
Sorry.
So that would be more like going to the lattice and.
To the letters.
Lattice.
Discrete time.
No, I mean just when you look at those types of compositions, you're just looking at the step by step.
Yeah, okay.
But sometimes I guess I also like to think that in our situation, you just talk about TQ of T, but actually the time is continuous, underlying continuous time, and TQ of T is just a way to kind of analyze things in terms of the finite generating relations. Because you don't find that number like generating morphisms now when you discretize it. If you don't, then it's a more continuous process, harder. So for example, in the case of grading anions, you know, you can say every time the anion, like within the 2D surface, you can have 1 through n of anions. And then you grade it, you can say whenever they return to their original position or swap position with each other, then that's considered discrete time step. But of course, what happens in the middle, augmented collision are physically happening and maybe kind of continuously. So, you know, you can go back and ask the question, even though I want to study this in terms of topological quantum theory, but what happened is that there is a continuous time flow and you can geometrize these topological objects back in order to correspond to the physics. So, you know, that would be how you find a good physical translation, explain why it's like a T of T, T of Q, NM models, you are going back to relating to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah, so, well, speaking about time, yeah, maybe this would be a good point to stop, although it's just about discussed half. So I wanted to explain this Dyck-Raff-Witten model, and then sort of start from, well, last week's kind of BF theory, and so it's kind of just BF theory is just for a finite group, so it's much simpler. We don't have to bother actually. So the action, for example, vanishes, right, because all these differential forms are identically zero because the Lie algebra vanishes. So that I just wanted to basically define this kind of simple case, the TQFT, and sort of the physical picture first. And then calculate the associated Frobenius algebra.
That's always next week.
Mm. Might be better, yeah, than two.
Let's squeeze that into 5 minutes.
Yeah.
What you can tell me, because I just don't know, what is the Frobenius algebra? And it is the kind of
right, okay.
Satisfying.
Good point, thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
So, let me start by defining what a commutative Dyck-Raff Frobenius algebra is. And so that is just a Hilbert space H together with maps eta and mu satisfying all this stuff.
All right. So you say that's the name of the algebra. You say a Dyck-Raff Frobenius Dyck-Raff.
So commutative.
Commutative.
Dyck-Raff Frobenius algebra.
It shouldn't be a Hilbert. Is it a Hilbert space or an algebra?
Do
you need the Hilbert space structure at some point?
Yes, we need a Hilbert space structure because of the Dyck-Raff, because the co-multiplication is supposed to be, or actually in this case defined to be, the adjoint, the Hermitian conjugate of the multiplication.
So,
is it in some way, I mean, you can just say that Ithaca, instead of defining as a Fubini Sarasabaya, I mean, this is an example of hop algebra, right?
Is it? I don't really know much about hop algebras.
I mean, they have both multiplication and co-multiplication.
But do they satisfy the same laws?
No, yeah, you choose some specific, I mean, there's some specific example of
oh, okay. So, but there's this. So, what is the compatibility in the Hopf-Algebra case between multiplication and co-multiplication?
Yeah, what was the biology?
I think it's. But
there's. Is there?
I used to know this.
The question is that's the same as the Frobenius law there. But there's also identity.
I guess he would have
mentioned
it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess we can
click on it.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. We can just look it up.
Okay. Yeah,
oh, but this goes to the inlet. Maybe this would be too.
Yeah, but if you go back there, it says it's almost a Hopf algebra.
Yeah.
Almost, which means it's not. I mean, you have a whole algebra, and then by in the algebra, maybe the compatibility condition is a little different.
Okay, that's the relation.
No, but this is quite different. No, I mean we also have. So this is the multiplication. This is the co-multiplication.
Yeah.
We also have this thing appearing in.
But
the left hand side is different.
Different. Yeah.
So if you had that, you would have gotten a Hopf algebra. But we don't get that. That's
what's. Right. Yes. Uh-huh.
We only get one side. You mean we don't get the two sides together?
Yeah, but we get something completely different, no?
No, but we get something just take one pair string, not two. So if you superimpose those two, then you get something like the Hopf algebra, left hand side and the right hand side. I don't know what that diagram below exactly means, right? But basically, yeah.
Well, are you saying that this thing, this relation is somehow compatible with the other one?
Yeah,
that this implies, so you're saying that. The other one implies this. This one implies the other one?
No, the other way
around. No,
the other
way around. Yeah. Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
if
this.
Anything,
no.
It's weaker.
If anything, the other one would imply this.
Yeah.
Because we do not get that.
Yeah, okay.
But
yeah.
I'm not sure if that's
Yeah. Or it may just look superficially similar. It may just be superficial. In any case, now we could also drop this Dekker here. So what commutative means is obvious, no, I guess. We have this commutativity law here, and if we just don't require this, then we just get a Dekker of Frobenius algebra.
Mm-hmm. But you flip it to get a co-commutative.
It's
also co-commutative, right?
Right, yeah. And just the Frobenius algebra? Well, in that case, it would just be given not by a Hilbert space, but by a vector space, together with a multiplication, a unit, and a co-multiplication, which then is an extra piece of data.
How did you get
the
vector? just defining, just explaining what a Frobenius algebra is.
But it has a vector?
No.
You don't want it? Oh,
here, yeah.
Yes, Frobenius.
So just a vector space with a multiplication like this, a co-multiplication like this, which is then something completely independent, and a delta or something, and a unit, eta, like this, and also a co-unit, which is a linear map from H to C, and still satisfying just all these laws. And so in this case, then the second, so then this row, it's really independent of the first, right? It doesn't follow from the first. So this is what a Frobenius algebra then is. But I don't really know what they're useful.
Did you talk about in the thesis?
I don't know. Well, these ones definitely, yes. Although I suspect he actually got something.
So you have to drop maybe more axioms and non-nations.
Yeah, for it, just drop this axiom.
All right.
And you get the general notion of Frobenius function.
Okay, we see that here. We need more. You need that actually those two guys are topologically equivalent, so you just
right. Yes, yes, yes. So for the CQFTs, we need all these.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess that's all.